Virgil, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. I was just thinking about this a little bit recently. I spend a lot of time coaching the golf swing, and it's amazing how many times people will come back to work on the minutiae of where the wrist angles are, check the pivot, am I fully turned, how's my transition, yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, people hear and read and watch the mental game chatter, but generally speaking, they only give it lip service, as in like, oh, wow, I really want to do that. But when they get in the arena of playing, they instantly revert back to who they naturally are, and they don't necessarily know why, and they want to change, but yet they're not. And I'm almost thinking that maybe they need to have a mental coach equally and opposite of the swing coach, because the mental routine and the mental management of golf, although different than the physical parts, obviously, the same amount, if not more, should go into the mental routine. Talk to us about that thought.
Well, you know, because I've also done both, you know, teaching the game and the techniques and you know, positions and swing and all that stuff. But I'll tell you what, as I really dug deeper into what it means to train the mind in order to access coordinated movement, to access the best athleticism that a person can produce with the skill that they currently have, it became clear to me that what an opportunity to help a person get better at the technique stuff simultaneous to getting better at how to perform. You know, how many times do we have these players, and I'm sure your listeners can all relate to this, we talk about it all the time, they're able to do it on the range. They know they can. They do it brilliantly sometimes in stretches and games and lessons and in practice. But then when the rubber meets the road and they're trying to perform well on the golf course, whether it's the Saturday game with the fellas, or it's a high school or college player or an adult amateur, and really wants to perform, and how often do they just, you knew when you left them, they were doing great, and then they come back and they go, yeah, I just couldn't do it. So there's so much of that out there. And what I have really dedicated the second half of my 30 years of teaching the game has been a complete focus on tracking and understanding the latest in research in mental performance and what happens in the mind that enables the body or disables the body from doing what it can do. And there are so many little elements to that now that they are researching far and wide across the world. I mean, Harvard, McKinsey, certainly in the world of golf, you have people wearing devices on their heads that are emanating reading brainwave activity while they're in performance. And you and I both know that those tools give us interesting insight, but you can't always have those tools with you. But what can you do? And I always say this, it always comes back down to this. And I was out with a bunch of veterans today in the PGA Hope program down here in South Carolina, Charleston. And they asked me to start to put some thought into helping all the teachers and coaches as well as the players understand the mental game a little bit. And I said, look, recognize this simple fact. If you are having any kind of verbal conversation inside your head as you're walking up to preparing your waggles and your practice week and starting to make your golf swing, you're in trouble. You're not going to tap your best efforts very often that way. Now, who out there doesn't do that to some degree?
Not many.
No. And those are habits. So what I have done and what's exciting now for me is with training in technology in neuroprogramming and neurotiming, in hypnosis, meditation and mindfulness, and a host of other things that I call my suite of techniques, technologies, and tactics, I have organized an approach that allows me to work with players remotely. They can be face-to-face if it's convenient, but I can do these training sessions and live with people for the course of 30 days. And sometimes we're interacting on a daily basis because the habits that we want to be able to bring to the lesson tee, to the practice tee, to the golf course, aren't just going to get built there hitting some golf shots here and there. You know, we have lives. They're busy. There's many different areas that we have habits built that are not productive, and they're not helping us when we go on the golf course. And guess what? They're not helping us in many aspects of our lives. Hmm.
So what you're saying, what you're saying is that right now a listener could be contacting you and set up a month's training in which they could actually maybe FaceTime or Skype you, and they could be actually playing golf, and you could help them retrain their behaviors and patterns and habits of how they think before they pull the club, what they think about before they swing the golf club. All those things, you can do that remotely.
Absolutely. In fact, if people have been familiar following Jason Day's career, knowing that, you know, he almost quit because he had the driver yips, then the guys who invented that mind-sensing technology called the Focus Band met him and showed him, hey, we can read what's going on, and you're kind of getting a different reading when you're about to go hit your driver than you are the rest of your clubs. 3 weeks later, he was using it every day. 3.5 years later, he was number one in the world, and everybody remembers when before he got his injury, that guy was doing a routine that people could tell was different, right?
Yeah.
He was closing his eyes and things like that. Now, I know a lot about that because I was with those guys in the development of the Focus Band with Jason Goldsmith and all those and
Henry Bolton and Graham
Henry and Graham, right?
Yeah.
And what we know is that it wasn't just when he was on the golf course that he was doing those things, although he did build some very specific routines. It didn't have to change anything about what he was doing technically or how he went about his shot routine physically. It had to do what was going on in the processes of his mind, that once he understood and trained himself to do something different and consistently different, it ended up moving into consistency in his performance, and he, you know, rose to the top. And others, and as soon as that happened, then Justin Rose said, I want that.
Yep.
And he started doing it. And of course, the Focus Band is a great tool. But there are so many different pieces that can be organized into simple exercises that can be done on a daily basis, even if you're not going to go to the golf course that day, that I take people through. Because I don't only teach golfers. I teach other types of athletes, professionals, and amateurs. And I also teach business executives in focus and concentration. The power of harnessing what I like to call the zone flow state has been studied now for the last half decade. And the power in it for productivity, creativity, ability to problem solve, which are all things that actually fit right into playing better golf, but they also make a difference in the life of a teacher, the life of an executive, the life of any person who said, God, there's a lot of stuff going on in my mind because I've got so many different elements and aspects of my life. How do I train my mind to be more productive, learn more effectively, and produce what I want in a more rich environment? And that's what I'm doing more and more of, and it's fun stuff to do, too.
Yeah, no doubt about it. When I think about the last maybe 5 years of work, some of my favorite people, like Stephen Kotler and the Flow Genome Project and Jamie Williams, mm-hmm. and all the things that those guys are doing,
yep.
It sounds like it's way down the rabbit hole for the average person who just learned about it for the first time. But it's actually everything that they're teaching, everybody's capable of doing. They just don't know how to access it. So it's not like it's a gift that only certain people have. Everybody has it within them. How would you go about, kind of step us through, because obviously every person's different, so you can't really say that you're going to be giving it all away here. What would be like, step us through like a routine that would be in this month-long program with you? What would it be like?
Sure. So one of the first things that has to happen, of course, is a very good heart-to-heart conversation about, you know, who you are as a player, what your you know, what your highlights have been, what your lowlights have been, what you really feel like you're struggling with, and what you think you're close to breaking through on. And everybody's different about that. Yeah, so there's getting a lot of feedback from a player right up front to find out what they really want, helping me understand through a lot of questioning what it is that, you know, is unique about that person. That person, whoever they are, they've got strengths in golf. They may have strengths in other sports or other activities. In one case, I tapped a female who was looking to play college golf and beyond it, and we found out that she was an actress. She did a lot of that theater. That became a huge theme, and she and only one other varsity athlete who was the Heisman Trophy candidate for Northwestern were the only two in the theater department at Northwestern University who have played varsity sports.
Was Rebecca Halpern one of those?
You know that's who it is.
How about that?
How'd you know Rebecca? Yeah, Rebecca and I go way back.
Actually, Rebecca Halpern and I worked at Winnetka Golf Club, and she spent a lot of time at Winnetka Golf Club back in when she was in high school. That's when I met her.
She walked up to me as a redhead in high school because I was working with, I don't know if you remember, Shannon McDonald from Michigan. And Rebecca came up to me and said, I want to be as good as her, and my dad's going to call you. I don't know if you know, Rebecca Halpern's dad built the Sears Tower.
He was a great man. Great man.
Great man. Gosh, Virgil, we knew each other back then. I didn't even know we did that.
That is absolutely hilarious.
You remember the Green to Tee Golf Academy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is 1995 for me. 1995 is when I was in Chicago.
That was my academy.
Yeah, how about that? That's awesome.
I didn't realize that. So, yes, that's Rebecca Halpern. But another person, you know, played in instruments, and so we could tap the musical piece. The point being, in that first session, there's so much information that gets called down to what do you want, and then what fits into the way you are going about your day-to-day so that we can create a routine that is going to very likely start when you wake up, and they get to build it. So I can make suggestions, but each individual gets to build a routine, because if you want to train your mind and your body to perform better, then there's things you need to start doing on a regular basis. So we talk about, well, what fits into your day and when can you do these things? And then how fast can you start to implement this stuff? Because this stuff is not hard to do, as you point out. It just needs somebody who's willing to help coach you a little bit in it.
No doubt about it.
And hold you accountable. And then, of course, what do we do specifically when you're moving towards golf shots, practice, taking lessons, going out and playing? Absolutely. I get to hold their hand through that process. But if you wanted a specific, you know, I do some whiteboard presentations, but I never can them, so they would be, you know, live, like you said, through mm-hmm. Skype or Zoom or something. And then we really do create the processes in the mind, in the questioning and or the quieting, in the process of selecting a club and moving through all the way till hitting the shot, and then also after.
Joe, how can my listeners get in touch with you to sign up for this month-long program?
So they would reach out either going through my email, joeboscogolf@gmail.com, or they could shoot me a text message or a phone call at 847-826-0045. That's my phone number. And then I can give them kind of the, you know, the pitch. Tell them this is what it is, and this is how I'm offering it, you know, at a lot less than I would normally. Just flat out, it's normally $1,500 a month for somebody to do this. But, you know, I work with executives and things like that. But I'm going to do something below $1,000 for a 30-day period of time, and it actually will probably end up being with some follow-up after the 30 days, because I want people to get this. I want them to really see. But I can guarantee this. They're going to play at least 9 holes, if not 18 holes, better than they have in the past. They give this a chance to work. It really, it never fails. People really say, wow, there's something to all this. And you know, it makes a difference. It makes a difference.
Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to join me out of your busy schedule. I look forward to having you on again really soon, buddy.
Sounds great. Thanks, Virgil.
My pleasure, buddy.
Talk with you.
When we return, we're going to talk with Jim Nugent. We're going to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here at 104.5 The Zone.
Are you dragging it?
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here at 104.5 The Zone. If you want to get involved with the show, hit me up on Twitter. I am at Virgil Torspin. It's at this time every Saturday morning. We're at Monday's headlines on Saturday morning with the founder of Global Golf Post, Jim Nugent. Nuge, how are you today, buddy?
Virgil, thank you very much for having me on today. Good to be on.
Well, Kevin Na gets another victory, and he made more putts in 1 week than I've made since, like, Bill Clinton was president, with like 580 feet of putts made. He nearly donated it back to Patrick Cantlay, and then Patrick Cantlay donated it right back to Kevin Na. But Kevin Na is becoming like this pretty unique guy who used to be ridiculed for his slowness of play, but now has this little funny walk-in with all of his putts, which he made 1,000 of during the week. But he's turned into a pretty likable guy. What's your take on the current version of Kevin Na?
You know, Kevin Na has kind of rehabilitated himself in the court of public opinion. He was, for a period of time, kind of held up to scorn, by Golf Channel and by the networks because of his slow play. There were a couple of instances where he just, couldn't pull the trigger. And it was unfortunate because he's a very good player and he's a very good man. But he was jumped on in the politically correct environment that we live in about his pace of play. And he's worked very hard to correct that. But he's also worked very hard to create a bit of personality to endear himself to the golfing public. And the walking in of the putts has really been an interesting little internet meme, if you will, and it certainly got a boost from Tiger. I think it was at the Players Championship.
It was
when Kevin walked one in, and then Tiger walked one in right behind him, and they smiled and they fist bumped, and all of a sudden Tiger gave a legitimacy to Kevin Na that he couldn't buy or pay for.
Yeah, no kidding. It's interesting. I didn't quite follow along with the message that he said in Korean at the end, or what it meant, but what was the message behind his words in Korean at the end of his victory speech? Did you catch up on that?
I did, and I didn't quite get it under. I didn't quite understand it myself. I'm not sure that it was anything much more than homage to his homeland, to his family, to his parents. I don't think there was a political message there at all. I don't speak Korean. I don't like Korean. I haven't talked to Kevin or his people. So I'm going to take it at face value. It was just a thank you and an appreciation for what people in Korea and his Korean heritage has meant for him.
That's interesting. It's also a pretty hot topic in the golf world because this past week, Byo Kim won a Korean Tour event and then was immediately disbarred, so to speak, a 3-year suspension. Pretty radical. Unless you read the article about the history and the culture of the Korean people and why that happened that way, to Americans it seems super duper severe, but to the Korean people it seemed like it was not really that big of a blip on the radar screen and a pretty it was almost applauded by the Korean people. What was your feeling on the situation with Byo Kim?
Well, I initially thought, as you did, and probably as most Americans did, that that's a bit of a death penalty, right? 3 years when you're coming into your peak age performance, and he's a good player on the Korean Tour. I think he was leading the order of merit or their money list, whatever they have over there. And to be sat down for 3 years, I thought, wow, that's like telling Duke that you got a decade off. But our Steve Eubanks at Global Golf Post did some probing into this and talked to a number of Korean people, LPGA players, agents, and the Korean people were nonplussed by that. That action that he took was akin to, I'm not going to come up with the proper metaphor, but perhaps in the United States, it's akin to burning the American flag. It was flagrant. It was violent. It was vile, and nobody in Korea seems to have a real issue with the penalty that was assessed to this guy. And even he is kind of like, well, you know, I did it, I shouldn't have, and now I got to pay the price.
Wow. It's interesting. I've been reading a book on different cultures and how certain things that would be deemed okay in one culture is like blasphemy in the other. I never really would have given it much thought, but in some ways I applaud a country and or a group of people standing up for its own heritage and its own beliefs. Maybe some other tours could follow suit with that in some ways.
Well, you know, in the environment that exists over in Asia right now with China and Korea, I'm not sure that any of us know all of the issues, understand all of the issues, or are qualified to comment on them. I think this is one that's just best left alone right now.
Yeah, no doubt. John Rahm gets his fifth European Tour victory and repeats in style. John Rahm is, many people are considering the best player without a major, and he's so young to have that title. Big win for John Rahm. He made a little bit of history, too.
Yeah, he won his fifth European Tour event in a about 10 years shorter span than Seve Ballesteros. I think it was like, I don't know what the numbers were, but it took Seve 36 years or something like that to win five European Tour events, and John lapped him on that. But he's just, an extension in the line of great Spanish players that Seve started, handed it off to Jose Maria, handed it off to Sergio, and now there's John Rahm. And I don't think right now that John Rahm is mature enough or old enough to understand the mantle that has been handed off to him. I think he's figuring it out, and I think he will figure it out. But he's the inheritor of a very grand and important tradition in European golf. And when he figures that out, I think he's going to be a great representative of the game in Europe and in Spain. I think he's going to be a great Ryder Cup player. But it's all coming at him right now so fast. He's just 2 years out of college, and I think his head is just kind of exploding with some of this stuff. But he's a really, really raw talent who's only going to get better and is going to be on the landscape around the world as a global player for a long time to come.
No doubt about it. Nuge, how can my listeners get a copy of the Global Golf Post and GGP Plus?
They can go to our website, globalgolfpost.com. They can sign up for our free Monday digital magazine, which will tell you everything you need to know about what happened in the game of golf around the world last week. And they can also sign up for our subscription product, GGP Plus, where we deliver original premium quality content that you can't find anywhere else with no advertising. I think that your listeners will love both of our products.
No doubt about it. Nuge, thank you so much for taking the time to join me. I look forward to having you on again next week, buddy.
Thanks for having me on, Virgil. Cheers.
My pleasure. All right, we return. We're headed to the Orca Driving Range with George Gankis. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here, 104.5.
This Sunday.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. At this time, every Saturday morning, we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca Driving Range, where we bring in the best teachers in the world to help you with your game. And today is no different, as we are very blessed to have possibly the hottest name in all of golf instruction, George Gankis. George, how are you today, buddy?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm great.
Well,
how are you guys doing?
Fantastic. Doing fantastic. It's been a great week for me here as the high school team, the high school that I work for. We won the state championship for the first time. So right now I'm kind of in the throes of a 7-day celebration with all the goods that go with that. So it's been a busy week for me. I'm almost feeling like I'm almost as busy as you, buddy, but you've been spending a lot of time in airports and driving ranges across the country with tour players. When you're working with tour players, it's been a while since I've been out there. When I had kids, I kind of stepped away a little bit. But talk to us about what it's like as a as a tour player coach. In some ways, it's more about making sure you don't mess them up as it is anything else. What's been in your experience in the last year or so on the driving range working with the best players in the world?
Well, you got two types of coaches. You got players, performance coaches, guys who are looking at stats and trying to better you at every position of the game, whether it's mental, whether it's, you know, their driving stats or their short game, putting, iron play, whatever it might be, strategy. That's a performance coach. Then you have technical coaches that are out on the course. Then you have people who are both, you know what I mean? So for me, I try and do both, but some people just want me as technique and some want me just as performance coaches. So in general, I usually, for all the guys I'm on tour, it's pretty much both. A couple of them, I'm more technical, and that's most likely because, you know, they don't understand that you know, that I can play golf myself. So the thing is, it's fun going out there, but a lot of them, like Matt Wolf or Akshay, players that I've been with for a long time, you know, it's not so much technique all the time. It's more of, okay, strategy, what they're thinking for the week, mental stuff. That stuff is fun for me. Technical stuff's easy. As I look on it, I'm like, I know what I want to do. And if you're willing to do some stuff, it's pretty easy. But usually on tour, we're trying not to work on too many things like Monday, Tuesday, because they got to play. And if we clutter their brain with too much mechanical stuff, it's not an optimal way to do it.
Yeah. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on working with two of the best young players in the country, which would be Matt Wolf and Akshay. How are you getting them ready with the course strategy? Because obviously the golf courses are longer and the conditions are more difficult, greens firmer and faster, et cetera, et cetera. But what are some of the things that you constantly see yourself working on with them to get them prepared so early in their PGA Tour career?
Well, usually it's more of, you know, shot patterns for holes, whether it's coming into greens, you know, tuck right, tuck left. We work a lot of that on the driving range. So we're preparing for situations that are going to be on the course. And Matt Wolf's been doing that since we've been working since he was 13 years old. And Akshay, pretty much the same. You know, he's got his own TrackMan. He's got numbers. We do a lot of stuff where, you know, for him, he's got a, you know, tuck right pin like an Akshay. Which he's not a drawer of the ball, he's a cutter of the ball, but, you know, he's got 175 yards. I'll be like, what do you want to hit? And he goes, I can hit an 8-iron or 7-iron. I'll have him have half 7-iron to tuck right pins if it was a back pin, and 8-irons if it was, you know, a harder pin where he wanted to draw it in there. So we have different situations where he's coming in higher to front pin, lower to land it shorter. But the distance controls there and not crossing pins is huge without being too conservative. Wolf's the same way. You know, he's so good at not crossing pins. He's so good at front pins because he hits the ball so high. And he's got such control of, you know, his trajectory and his spin control. So things like that are fun. And we've worked on those on the range for so long. It's just, you know, second nature.
Interesting. When you feel like, you know, because obviously Matt had a great college career and Akshay was going straight basically from high school to the tour. How far apart are they in their development as you're watching two of the best young players in the world play?
I don't think there's a mechanical or a physical huge difference. I think it's more of a mentality and, you know, understanding who belongs and who doesn't, who believes they belong and who doesn't. Hmm. I think Wolf from the very start believed he belonged on the tour. But I think if Wolf started 17, like Akshay did, just like I've talked to some really like smart guys that have been out on the tour for a long time, no one's been able to perform at a great level at 17 years old. So he's stepping into some crazy, like, you know, water, like trying to get in and think that he's going to, you know, crush it at 17. You know, he's never seen the courses they're playing. You know, he hasn't traveled like this. You know, he's not worldly. But the kid's just, he's a phenomenal golfer. And all he has to do is just keep preparing. And you know, mentally, that's what we're working on more than anything with Akshay, because he has all the other gifts. And mentally, he's so strong too. But mentally, he's got to believe that he belongs. And, you know, right now, he's played a couple of tournaments and he's missed the cut. And really, it's been, you know, him trying to make the cut rather than trying to win a golf tournament. And he's never done that before. It's usually I'm trying to win. And now he's playing very conservative golf, not trying to mess up. And rather than just going out and playing golf like he's always done, he's playing very conservative. And on the tour, you know, you got tuck right pin, tuck left pin, and you're trying to hit it to 20 feet because you don't want to make a bogey. You're not going to actually compete. You know, it's going to be hard, let alone trying to make a, you know, a cut. So, you know, where Wolf is going to, you know, fire at pins, he just doesn't care.
Do you believe in, because that's interesting, because, you know, Scott Fawcett, who's becoming another big name in the golf industry with his golf strategy piece, is talking about fat side of the green 72% of the time and, you know, just leaving yourself in the right position and stop making bogeys and stop trying to make birdies. But I recently also had Stuart Sink's caddy, Kip Henley, on, and he talks about if you want to win golf tournaments, that might not be the best mode to go about it. What's your mental opinion on the management of when to go for it, when to be aggressive, when not to be aggressive, et cetera, when it comes to that golf course strategy piece that you were just discussing?
Well, here's the deal. Scott Fawcett's a genius. The other guy's very, very smart. Here's the deal. To me, it all depends on how a player has confidence going into it. You can tell somebody this is statistically the right way to hit a pin, but you've been hooking it all week and you got a tuck left pin. You're going to be more conservative. It's situational to me. But in general, when a player's firing on all cylinders like Akshay has, ball striking wise, Wolf, they can actually, you know, beat the stats. And when I say, is that smart? No, it's situational. If you don't feel good, you know, play more towards the middle of the green on a tuck left pin. And you know, if it overdraws, you're still fine. But if you want to actually win a golf tournament, you know, there's times where, okay, let's make the cut. And then, you know, maybe we're 500, 600. Now let's like start to be a little more aggressive. Is there a time and place for me situational, you know, if I'm playing for fun, I'm going to go at a lot more pins, but I'm still going to be on a tuck left, starting it right and turning it towards and tuck left. I mean, start tuck left, I'm going to start it right and turn it, and tuck right, I'm going to start left and turn it towards the pin. But the fact is if you're trying to win this week, this is what we talked about with Akshay, you know, is I was sitting at lunch and I was watching Shot Tracker. And he had 140 yards. He hit it like 330 and he had 140 yards with water right. And one guy hit it short, one hit it long. And I put my finger down, swear to God on my life, on exactly where he's going to be because I just know where his mindset's at. I said he's going to be 20 feet to the left of this pin. And guess what? He was 24 feet to the left of the pin. My hand was right on the dot. So the thing is, I just knew where his mindset was up. He was trying not to mess up rather than, you know, playing like he would normally. But that's normal. He's 17 years old. He's going to learn, and he's going to get more comfortable. And when he does, I don't care if he misses every cut right now. I don't. What I care about is that he's learning, and by the time he's 19, he's going to be it's going to be brutal. He's going to belong. I promise you that.
That's fantastic stuff. When we return, we're going to finish up our interview with George Gankus. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here at 104.5 The Zone. This Sunday. It's time to finish strong, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. I'm going to finish up our two-part interview with possibly the most famous and hottest golf instructor in the land, George Gankus. George, a lot of people talk about your golf swing information, and it's phenomenal, but I've listened and watched so much of your videos, and I think that you got some brilliant stuff in the short game that I'd love for you to share. And I think one of the things that we see here in the southeast part of the country is the Bermuda grass that's cut tight, and it generally speaking, because all the greens are slightly elevated and the grass grows back into the grain around the green, and it's kind of a difficult shot for the average player, but it's also not an easy shot for the best players in the world either. Talk to us about that into the grain shot and how to best utilize the bounce and the body, how they work together to deliver the club properly into the turf so that it doesn't dig, skids across the turf, and hits a nice shot around the green.
Well, I mean, that's something that's been for a while. First off, you know, a lot of people are trying to use 60s. And a lot of my players, if you get into the grain in Bermuda, a lot of them are using 56 and they're opening up a little bit. So that's a little bit more forgiving. A lot with technique.
a lot of players who are trying to use some leading edge to that are just going to get punished. You know, you can hit good shots, but they're going to come in low and hot. But also, you're going to get exposed by the leading edge, and if you barely miss it, it's going to dig in and make you look real stupid. So it becomes sketchy. So the hardest thing for a lot of players is who are good ball strikers, they lean the handle. And that works, but if you got a front pin and you got it into the grain in Bermuda, you got to use the bounce. So that being said, there's a lot of different techniques people use. You got like a Jason Day or a Stricker, you know, very little wrist hinge. And for a lot of players, they don't like the feel of that. So I don't mind the feel of it. I've got a lot of players who hate the feel of that, but it works. So whether it's getting the handle back, whether it's opening the face a little bit, whether it's actually lowering the hands and getting the feet a little bit wider to expose the bounce. The problem is a lot of times when people take it back, they take it back with a little bit more flexion. And what we need to do is keep the cup and the trail on the lead hand. And if you have any kind of form roll with actually some cup, you're going to get some radial, which is an upward hinge. And you better learn to throw that back out because if you don't, you're going to actually expose some leading edge. So the fact is most players who do hinge it have to throw it back. And the more you open it up in the back with some cup, you can throw that bounce. But the problem is a lot of people throw it and they still hit behind it. So you got to keep your rotation through the shot. And I think that's a big, big problem is because that's getting your low point forward with the throw. And so there's a lot of different technique you can use there. For a lot of my players, they're either starting it more open with a 56 or they're actually opening it up in the back with some, you know, extension to trail wrist with a little form roll, which adds to some radial. And you combine all those and you throw them back out and you open up your chest. I have a lot of different techniques for it that a lot of my players use. I've got a lot. So, basically did that yesterday in the membership and my membership site. But there is a lot of different ways because you can get in big trouble out there.
Yeah, I think that you hit on a couple of critical pieces for me. One, which is there's about three different ways to pitch the ball. You know, one is what I call almost like a lead arm motion like Mickelson has, like a hinge and a hold. And then there's more of a trail arm motion like Siekman and Stan Utley. And then there's like the body rotation with the face slightly open like a Stricker and Jason Day, and they all work. You just have to do what you do a great job of on your website, which we're getting ready to get into, which is matching up things that you do well. And that's the
I think Siekman, those guys are genius with it. I mean, anytime you get a closed face, that trail arm's going to drive towards the target, just like a DJ. You get the face shut with ball strike and this trail arm moves forward more than anybody. It's like, I want to copy DJ with ball striking, but your face is wide open. Your ball's going right all day. So the fact is if the face is shut, yeah, your trail arm's going to move forward. And so the concept is with the Siekman is get the face more open, a little more form roll, a little more fold in the trail arm, and then never let that elbow drive towards the target. And what that's going to do is now you got to throw it a little bit with rotation to support the throw, and you can you know, use the bounce, and it works great. Whereas if you look at like a Jim Furyk, or not a Jim Furyk, but like a, what do you call it? Like a Jason Day, you know, that works. You get the handle back and you just basically turn and turn and keep the angle in the back of the wrist. That works really well. And then you look at like a Phil Mickelson where you hinge and hold, that for a lot of people is rough, but he's amazing at it. So you can never say that, you know, it's bad because he's probably one of the best in the world.
No doubt. Well, one of the things I love about your membership site and all of the work that you're doing is that you provide such a great roadmap in a variety of ways. Once again, more in like matchups and how you, like, if you know what you're doing here, think about it doing like this. When you put together the in your mind what you wanted your website to look like, I'm sure it took a long time because it's so thorough. Talk to us about your website and the membership program that you have and all the cool things that you're bringing to the table there.
Well, thanks for asking, first off. The first thing is what I want people to do is be educated. And not just for teachers, but for players. It really is going to open their mind to actually how many options they have, first off, what matchups go with what, and then understanding anatomical parts, because people, you know, sometimes think that they can do things, but their body doesn't even work that way. So it's really cool because they're going to understand, you know, the verbiage, they're going to understand, you know, how the body works, the biomechanics, and they're going to understand matchups. And so now there's a lot of ways to do it. And I believe more than anything, all my players are a little different. I look on tour, everyone's different, and that's good. There's not a problem with that. Because everybody has different ball flights, and prefer different patterns. But more than anything, there is a better way to do it. Okay, I promise you, for speed, for face control. And so there's a lot of things that are going to go in there, not just, you know, ball striking, whether it's driving or irons, but the short game's on there, the mental game's on there, strategy, you know, how to actually work on your game, stats. The whole works is on there, and it took 2 years for my partner and I to do it, and it was a lot of work. So the fact is we're going to continue to put stuff on there. You know, every week we're going to put stuff on there. We'll be able to talk to our members. They're going to be able to – we're going to provide them with feedback. They're going to be able to post their swings on there in our forum. And all we're trying to do is just help a lot of people understand and improve. And that would be my biggest goal, is because – you know, it's been my biggest thing. I love teaching, and I love it not just for, like, making money. I love it because I enjoy the satisfaction of watching people hit the ball better. It's just and score better. It's been something that you know, I get an adrenaline pump off. I really do. I really enjoy it.
Well, one of the things I love about it is that you've been cutting edge in both the delivery mechanism. You're what I call the king of cool, man. You did a great job of separating yourself in how you present your information, how you keep it fun. You got a great, almost got like a little group of followers that keep the game fun. And they're so loyal, and so it's such a cool thing. And I'm just so proud of you for that and all the things that you're doing.
Thank you. And I really appreciate it. I'm lucky to have some loyal followers. It's been a cool road to get here. I mean, it hasn't all been easy, but it's definitely rewarding to have the guys behind it, and I appreciate them all.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I'm sure you've experienced that. The closer you get to the top, the fewer hands you have reaching down to help you get to the top, buddy. But I'm a huge believer in what you're doing, and I'm grateful that you took the time to come on my show over your busy schedule. So best of luck to you in the future. I look forward to having you on again really soon. And let's hopefully I can get a chance to catch up with you really soon in person.
I appreciate it much. Thanks for having me on the show. And if you need anything on my end, holler at me.
I appreciate it, buddy. Look forward to catching up with you really soon.
All right. Thank you again.
Thanks,
have a
George.
Good night.
Yeah, you do this. All right. Thank you for making us part of your Saturday, because without you, there is no talking golf. For George Gankus, Joe Bosco, and Jim Nugent, and my producer, Jimmy Hopper, thank you for making us part of your Saturday. See you next week for more talking golf.